Welcome to Recovery Stories Yukon. The purpose of this podcast is to break stigmas, bring hope, and show that recovery is possible within our communities. Amber will be sharing her story today on the podcast. She's 35 years old, lives in Whitehorse, and her sober date is December 30th, 2023. Welcome, Amber. Please start your story wherever you'd like.
I am of Irish and Mohawk descent, the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte. Born in Whitehorse, and then I guess moved to Carmax with my mom and my dad. I don't know how old I was. You know, my mom and my dad moved there with me, and then I ended up living with my grandma when I was about 4.5 or 5 years old, just because my mom and my dad were drinking quite a bit at that point, quite heavily. So my grandma took me, and so my memories of Carmax are like, you know, she lived in this like little cabin on the river. You know, we had no running water, no electricity. We had like a little battery powered black and white TV and a radio phone, and then ended up moving to Atlin. And so when I say, like, when I introduce myself, I usually say that I'm from Atlin, and that's really because like that's where I grew up and that's where my heart is, and I have family there. And yeah, I moved there when I was 7. At that point, like, my grandma and me were like, we didn't jive very well together. I was pretty headstrong. And so was she. There was this family in Atlin. It was the Jack family, Joan and Brian Jack. They had a big family, and I really thrived in their house. Like, there was tons of kids and tons of stuff going on, and my grandma saw that. And so she kind of just let me spend a lot of time there. In the summertime, they went on the Nackinac River, which is, like, up from Taku. I mentioned the Nackinac because that's just, like, it's just my heart place. Like, that's just where my spirit is happiest. It really saved me when I got into my addiction. Like, I knew what life could feel like out on the river, so it kind of gave me hope. So I mentioned the Nackinac because, yeah, it was one of the big things that really saved me when I was really deep in my addiction. So yeah, I lived in Atlin until I was 14. I guess I should mention, like, my dad passed when I was 9 while I was in Atlin, and I mentioned that because that was just like a really, I think, the first time in my life where I had really big loss and really big grief and really couldn't manage my emotions, right? Like, I just really internalized it and really shut everybody out and really just like fell into depression and became angry, and kind of probably the intro to me wanting to escape, I guess, is what I would say. So it was weird too, like, when my dad died, my grandma pulled us out of school for a week or two, but when I went back, it was like all the kids didn't know how to handle that, or maybe I was different, but they ended up kind of like shunning me. I kind of became very isolated, and I very well could have done that myself, right? And pushed everybody away. I don't remember. I ended up starting to hang out with some of the older kids because the kids in my class just like didn't really want anything to do with me. And that's when I started smoking weed quite heavily, right? Like at 12 years old. I drank for my first time while I was still in Atlin too. I think I was like 13. I got alcohol poisoning so badly. It scared me, and I didn't touch alcohol again for a few years after that. So a blessing in disguise, I guess. So I moved to Whitehorse with my mom when I became 14. Like, instead of going to the dorm, my mom was like, I'll move into Whitehorse with you. You can like live, we'll live in Whitehorse together. And 14, grade 9. And that was really where my, like, that's when I started drinking, right? Like at 14, and really started like using a lot of other drugs as well. It was kind of like this perfect storm. Like, I was a very bright kid. I was getting straight A's, and I was like skipping class, and I was like drinking and using and like still getting straight A's. So I was like, well, what's the problem, right? I'm still getting straight A's. Like, it's not an issue, right? But yeah, like, I started like using like ecstasy and mushrooms, and I started selling them so that I could support my habit. Yeah, the whole while I was like, I'm good, right? I got this. Like, I definitely did not think of it as a problem throughout high school, but graduating high school, when you're in school, even when you're skipping all the time, there's still that structure, right? And so graduating, I kind of fell downhill. Yeah, so I think my next big milestone after that would probably be like having my son. Got pregnant 20, had my son when I was 20. And, you know, it was like not like me and his dad met. I was pregnant like 3 months later. Thank Creator. Like, as soon as I found out I was pregnant, I stopped drinking. probably if I was farther along in my alcoholism or my addiction, like that might not have been a possibility. But like I stopped while I was pregnant and like didn't crave, didn't have any of those cravings. And then right after, like I had them, those cravings came back. And then you're the stress of being a new mom as well, right? I think I went out when he was like 5 weeks old for the first time. And then again, like, you know, a month after that. And then it just kind of, like, I was still there. I was still a mom, especially when he was quite little. And then, you know, ask his grandparents, either my mom or Johnny's parents, to watch him and like go out for a night and be gone for 2 days and then be gone for three and then like, you know, be gone for four and that kind of thing. Still really trying to be a parent, right? And I think I walked that line for a long time. It just progressively got grayer and grayer. I did go to treatment for the first time when he was two for my alcoholism. At that point, I hadn't been touching any of the hard drugs yet, really, like dabbling once in a while, but nothing crazy. And it was good, right? It was really good. And I was in with a group of women. They were great, learned a lot, and then like just wasn't ready. Got out of treatment, and I think I was drinking again within like a couple of weeks. That's when I started using as well. So up until that point, like it was like I was drinking, and every once in a while I'd like use drugs to like sober up so I could drink more. And then so after that first bout of treatment, like it kind of flipped, and it was starting to become like where I was using more and more. And then I was like using alcohol to come down so that I could use more. Still being a mom, like still had my son. At that point, he was like five. Me and his dad started to share him. Like John would have my son for a week and then I would, and we'd go back and forth. And so I walked that line. Like when he was there, like I'd take him to school. I'd have dinner ready. Like I'd take him to the park. Like, you know, I'd do the mom stuff. And then when his dad would come and get him, I would just like party the whole time. And so then like I'd get my son back and I'd spend like a few days being sick and then a few days kind of figuring it back out and then like spend a few days being like, okay, I can use again in a couple days, like that expectation of using, right? Or that build up. Those lines got blurred even worse. Like I started to become where like I couldn't, you know, I was paying like half my bills and then like, you know, I was like getting in trouble with the landlady because like I was crazy when I was using and loud and like obnoxious, and I'd have like minimal food in the fridge, or like I'd have to get somebody to grab my groceries for me. So at that point, like I was using quite a bit of crack and like drinking. And then, so I ended up starting to use down or heroin. And that was kind of the point where I was no longer able to walk that line as a mother. Before then too, it was like that line blurring, right? Like I never used in the house with him. Right. And then it was like, oh, I would drink after he went to bed. And then it was like, oh, I would use after he went to bed. And then it was like, oh, I was using while he was awake. I remember him looking at me one time. I came out of the bathroom and he looked at me. He's like five. And he's like, who are you? He got scared. Like he didn't recognize his mother because my spirit was not there. Like it was not his mother. And they're so close to spirit at that age that, and it freaked me out. And I ended up going out of my apartment and being outside for a little bit and coming back in. But yeah, I started using down and I started nodding out. And I called his dad and I said, you need to come get your son. I can't parent him anymore. And he came and got him and I left him with his dad for a year and a half. And that was when my addiction really, really spiraled out of control. Because my son was like the one thing tethering me to any sort of normalcy or purpose or anything in life at that point. And so when John took him, I went downhill really fast. Like I was selling to support my habit in with like a group of people that were pretty crazy, you know, and I just kind of at that point didn't give a fuck. Like I was just like, I'm an addict, and I was an addict out in the open, and I didn't care who saw, and I was just like, this is my life now and I've accepted it and I'll probably die out here. Like that was kind of where I went. Because like, what's the point, right? I don't even have my son. That's kind of my headspace. And it's probably the only time in my life where I've been suicidal. So, and then people started dying around me. And, you know, that was my moment of clarity. I had three deaths happen to people really close to me in a really short frame of time.
Well, all of this was going on. I lived in the apartment above Oscar's Electric, so right beside the food bank. So, like, right on, Alexander, like, in the midst of all the craziness. And I had an apartment up there, and I was up there, and a really good friend of mine was right beside me, and we were both, like, selling and, like, causing havoc in those buildings. And then there was Big Bear beside us, and all of the people working at Big Bear, like, we were friends with all of them. But one of these young men would like come hang out after he got off shift. Very much like not meant for the drug life. Very sweet, very innocent. But he got messed up, mixed up with us, and he ended up getting hooked on down as well. And he ended up ODing. The night that he ODed, picked up from a friend of mine and asked me to come hang out with him. And I said, like, no, because I knew I'd get more drugs with my friend because he's selling them. So I said no, and he went home by himself, and he used, and he OD'd, and he died by himself. And then about a week later, the guy that I was seeing got shot and killed. Yeah, I don't want to get into that too deep, but yeah, he was shot and killed. And then about a week after that, my neighbor that I spoke of, Victor, he, that night it was rough. Like, I ended up getting like sexually assaulted that night. I was downtown. I was in a hotel. I came to realize what had happened, called him, and said, you need to come get me. And he came and got me and brought me to another friend's house, like a safe, house. And I used and nodded out, like went to sleep, and woke up to like chaos, and people were like running around, and like they were shaking me, and they're like, he's ODing, like we have naloxone, you need to do CPR on him. We called the ambulance, we need to leave. And so I had to do CPR on him, and I knew he was gone already. Those three men passed, and I had a moment of clarity, and I was like, if I don't get out of this life, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. And I guess I did want to live because 5 days after Victor passed, I went down to the referred care clinic, and I got on Suboxone. And that was hard in itself because you have to go into withdrawal to get on Suboxone. So like that was a rough go, but it was like I got on Suboxone, and then a couple like 3 months later or so, I was with somebody else, and we ended up moving up Fish Lake together. And so it was like that next step. I'm out of town. I'm not in the midst of it, right? I was still using, but I think my using probably got cut down to like a tenth of what I was using before. Got my old job back at 98, like a legitimate job. Cried when I got my first paycheck. Got on the list to get back into treatment. And went back into treatment for the second time. And I was like, there. I was like, give me everything you have, like a front row, doing homework. What else do you have? What do I need to do? Like, what do I need to do? I can't, I have, like, this is life or death. Got hooked up with counseling, going to meetings. So wanted what those people had, right? Like all smiles and like warmth and welcome. And like it was like this huge wall was up, and like I wanted it to come down, but I had absolutely no idea how to do that. Went to my first NA meeting while I was in treatment, and this girl, so she was out there using with us, like with me and Victor, quite a bit. Like she was a really close friend, and we used together quite regularly. And all of a sudden, one day, she was just like gone. And I was like, did she OD? Like, what happened to her? And so, like, 10 months later, when I go to my first NA meeting, she's chairing it. So, yeah, she came back and she was like in service with 12 step. And yeah, she was chairing the first meeting. And like, I thought she was dead. And so, seeing her gave me that first glimpse of like, if she can do it, I can do it. Like, this isn't impossible. It gave me that hope again. Graduated treatment and like really dove into like DBT and counseling and NA and AA and was in like step groups, and like you go from spending 24/7 using to getting clean and going, I have 24 hours a day that I have to fill up. What the heck am I gonna do? And so just really trying to fill as much as I could, even if I didn't understand what they were talking about, even if I didn't, I just put myself out there. When I got out of treatment, went back up Fish Lake, and it just really didn't work out up there, living situation, like immediately when I got back. And so my grandma, I called my grandma. She's like she's kind of my rock. And she said, I have a camper. You can live in my camper. And so I took her camper and pulled it out to a good family friend. He lives out in 5 Mile. Pulled this little tiny, like, 8-foot camper out there. 35 below, no heat. And I lived out there and I stayed clean. I wanted it. I wanted it. That's the difference, I think, right? Like, when you're ready, you're ready. You know, trying to, like, build these life skills that I had no idea. You know, I had to relearn how to do everything. Everything gave me anxiety. Like, I couldn't even drive without being high. Like, I couldn't go to the grocery store. I couldn't talk to people. I couldn't sit with myself. I couldn't do anything clean. I didn't know how. Like, I had to relearn how to do. Then moved into town at the end of Ogilvy, and that was a struggle, too, because I was renting the basement, and a good friend of mine that I used with a lot was renting above. All these people I knew were coming up there and partying and knocking on my door. But again, was like, no, leave me alone. Like, I remember, like, walking through town and I'd see somebody coming towards me and I would just, like, yell out. I would, within earshot, I'd be like, I'm clean now. Like, I'm clean. I don't want nothing to do with anything. And they'd be like, right on. That's awesome. And they'd carry on. Like, 9 months maybe after I got out of treatment, I had my first relapse, and it was a guy that I was with got shot and killed. It was his trial, and I was being forced, like being subpoenaed or whatever, to come testify at it. And the fear around all of that for my safety and for reliving all of that, I was like full of fear. I went back to the only coping thing I knew, which was to use to get rid of it. And to reinsert myself into the lives of the people that were also involved so I could be like, hey, like, I'm not ratting. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, please accept me still. I was kind of how that happened. And so, yeah, I went back out, and I think I went back out for like 5 weeks. And I remember again, like, another moment of clarity where I was like in my house using with my buddy, and we're like, you know, in like, ugh. I remember like having another moment, literally picturing myself on this like fence and being like, you know what? And it was like, I knew in my headspace that if I spent one more day using, I was gonna fall that last little bit and be lost again. And so I kicked my friend out, fell asleep, and woke up and didn't pick up, and started that journey again. Relapse is a big part of my story. I think it's a really big part of a lot of people's stories. You know, I know for me, like, I held a lot of shame around my relapses for a long time. My relapses got shorter and farther apart. But, you know, like, I ended up being homeless at one point, too, like, in recovery with my son. Like, I used over it. Like, I went and I used. And, you know, like, other relapses, like, mostly involved, like, men. Like, I would go back to what I felt like was a familiar man from, like, my childhood, watching my parent, you know. And then what I had developed as what was comfortable for a partner in me. And it was like alcoholic, you know, not very much in addiction as well. And like not really like able to talk about feelings or like find accountability or any of those things. And it was always me going back to that familiar person or, you know, set of traits and me looking outside myself to try to fix what was going on inside myself, which was that I was lonely. You know, because all it took for, like, you know, being with those men was for me to feel lonely and need them and for them to be drinking. It just takes that situation for me to go and be like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to drink too then, right? That was how each relapse. And then by the time you have one drink, you're picking up. Started going back down the river on the Nackinac again 4 years ago. Like I was saying at the beginning of my story, like the Nackinac gave me that hope while I was in the midst of my addiction because I knew what life could feel like. And it was from being on the river. And so I went back down to the river 4 years ago and oh my God, I cried and cried. Like I was just like, I am home after 20 years. Like I'm home. Oh, it's gonna make me cry right now. Those are the things that recovery brought me, like reconnecting. There was always like in the 12-step meetings, you know, and that's really where my recovery foundation is. It works for me. But there was always like something missing, and it was that reconnection to my culture, like traditional values that was missing from, and it was still in there. Like, you still look at the 12 steps and you're like, this is very much in line with our ways of doing things, right? When I figured that out and started taking those steps and started going back downriver and like building my son up, he's in dance group and we're doing hand games, and I got a job as a cultural support worker for the Whitehorse Aboriginal Women's Circle, and that was a big help for me too in my recovery journey, like helping women to connect with each other and connect with their culture and language and all that. Like, it's been beautiful. So yeah, that was really that part that was missing for me. So what works for me is the 12 steps and the traditional beliefs and values, having that balance between both. It took me a long time to figure out, you know, in the 12-step programs, they talk about higher power. And at the very beginning of my recovery, I thought I had to like pick a higher power, and that was like gonna be my higher power, without realizing that it's gonna evolve as I evolve. Like, my understanding of the world is going to change, and so therefore my understanding of my higher power is going to change. Maybe the fundamentals will be there, but it's, you know, as I grow, it's gonna grow with me. Today, like, my higher power is very simple, and it's connection. It's connection with myself on that like fundamental level. And I'm at a place in my recovery today where that can happen. Like, you know, earlier on in my recovery, like, I didn't not trust my gut at all. I didn't know what was my spirit and what was my addiction. I couldn't figure it out. And so now today, like, I know my spirit is strong in me now today, and I can hear it. And I know when I'm going against that or if I'm going for that. And my whole recovery is based on connection. If I'm by myself, if I'm isolating, like I said, my head can take me down pretty quickly. I constantly need people to bounce my stuff off of and to give me my recovery. Like, they speak. Everything I know today is because of what other people have told me or what other people have experienced, right? Like, that peer support. And then connection with land. Land is huge, right? Like, that's that higher power connection. All the plants and all the animals and the ecosystems and the sun and the moon and the seasons, like, they are all interconnected, and I can choose to tap into that interconnectedness or I can choose to tap out. When I tap out, you know, I'm living in my addiction and things get harder. It's like swimming up a river. You might still get there, but it's gonna be a lot more difficult. I know everything happens for a reason, and sometimes that hurts, right? We lose people. I lost somebody this morning. Fucking hurts. I had no idea that a life like this could exist. I remember the first time that I went like an entire morning without thinking about using. I was at that house on Ogilvy I was speaking about earlier. And it was like 11 in the morning. And I was like, oh my God, I haven't thought about using today. And then, of course, started thinking about using right after that. But like, that was another little piece of hope that I needed. It was like, it does get lifted, right? Everything is not taken over by the obsession to use today. Like, I can go for a walk. I can hang out with my son and be present. I'm not thinking about when I can pick up next or when I can go use again. And that, like, I'm so grateful for those things. Big and little, like, I'm still grateful. You know, I think us as addicts can find so much gratitude because we've had everything stripped from us in the past. Like, I can still find gratitude in a meal and in having socks and in, like, I was thinking about keys because like when I was in my addiction, I had no keys. I had like one house key that I had usually lost. Like, I usually had no keys and had to like break in through my own window to get into my house. And like now, like, you know, when I got clean, it was like, oh, now I have a car key and I have a house key. Oh, now I have a work key. Oh, now I have a friend's key because they trust me enough to like go and look after their house while they're gone. And so like, you know, grateful for keys. I remember being so grateful to have $5 and not want to go use it on a beer and going to the store to buy milk for my son. Those things. So grateful. And so grateful, like, for the big things too. The family. Like, my son. I get to be sober for my son today. And what a blessing that is. Those are the things I'm grateful for today.
Thank you so much, Amber, for being here today and choosing to share your story to help others.
Good night, Cheech, for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, you can get help by calling the Yukon Government Mental Wellness and Substance Use Services at 1-866-456-3838 or by reaching out to Theki Anate Fly Like an Eagle Program at 867-333-2497. If you would like to share your story on this podcast, please email recoverystoriesyukon@gmail.com.